Good morning, everyone. Well, the Bride of Christ. It's a great theological sort of title, but this is going to be really simple, okay? It's going to be really simple and really basic in a sense, but I just felt it was an element that God wanted us as a church to get hold of and to understand. But before I get into it, I just want to recognize and, you know, when you put a title like that up, people start thinking about their own situations, maybe their own marital status and things like that. And I do recognize that there are people here that are married, there are people here that are unmarried, there are people here that are divorced, there are people here that are widowed, there are people here that are single. We've got different experiences. So as I'm talking, and maybe as I give a few illustrations, I'm not talking about you in that respect, okay? What I'm simply trying to illustrate and get across is help our understanding of what I really sense Jesus wants us to capture this morning about being the bride of Christ as a church. Okay, that's what I'm getting at. I'm not digging at your situation or pointing a finger at you. And more importantly, what I'm getting at really is what difference does all of that make into how we conduct ourselves and in our daily lives. Right. Definition. I always like looking at a definition. A bride. A dictionary definition for a bride is a woman on her wedding day, including a period of time before and after it. Okay? So it's a period of time before and after it. You've probably all heard the expression, a bride-to-be. And when you hear that expression, you almost think of the immediate situation, you know, that they're getting married on Saturday or something like that. Here comes the bride-to-be. But I'm just trying to say that the term bride is actually a much greater period of time than that. And when you think of, like, the immediate preparations of a bride-to-be, you know, maybe she's going to have her hair done or something. You know, I'm talking about a traditional wedding that perhaps in our culture that we'd be familiar with. You know, she might want her nails done, or she might go and have a tan or something like that. And those are the sorts of preparatory things that you think of. But I want you to think of it as a much bigger concept. I mean, Nettie, my wife sitting down here, in my opinion, she's always been my bride, okay? She always will be. You know, she is my bride and she always will be, right? You know, the period of time that I'm talking about is much greater than what you initially sort of think of when you look at that. And, you know, in our culture, a traditional experience, you know, may look something like that, really. And, although I think it actually starts even before that, in the sense that a bride is born, okay? A bride is born and a bride is nursed and a bride grows up and a bride reaches adolescence and becomes a young woman and begins to mature. And all of this is what I'm saying is a time of preparation. And I think as a church we are living in a time of preparation. That's my point that I'm trying to get over. But when you think about the bride, I want you to consider what her behaviour is like, okay? If she's trying to attract the potential bridegroom, what is her behaviour like? I mean, she may make herself more attractive by the way she does her makeup, perhaps, or the way she dresses, or by the things that she says and the things that she does. And I think that's, you know, that's perfectly natural because she does the things that the groom likes to do. And it's quite amusing in a way when you look back and you see perhaps from your own experience how people have behaved, you know, it's sort of interesting in a sense. Now I'm just going to pick on somebody right now. Okay, can I borrow that mic? I'm going to pick on Jacqueline because she's sitting over here all good. Could you hold that and speak into that? Now then, Jacqueline, I t- take you to be the bride of Richard Miller. Is that correct?
I am.
Okay. Question for you. Have you ever been to a status quo gig?
Oh, yes, I have.
Okay. How many status quo gigs have you been to in your experience?
Probably over 10.
Okay. You've been to roughly 10-ish. Now then, if, just supposing, okay, you were not the bride of Richard Miller, how many status quo gigs do you think you would have gone to?
Probably none.
Probably none. When me and my wife were courting, I can always remember, we joke about it, you know, in a sense, but we went to North Wales. And because I enjoyed that sort of thing and outdoors and all that sort of stuff, we climbed Triffin. Do you remember? We climbed Triffin. You know, climbed the mountain Triffin. And the next day I actually asked her to marry me. Okay. Now, we've never been to Triffin again. But you see the point? The bride behaves in a way that is pleasing to the potential bridegroom or to the bridegroom. Okay? And that's the point, that it's natural and it's healthy for the bride to behave in a way that is pleasing to the bridegroom. You know, when you look back like that, you think that must have took a bit of effort, but I think in truth, that wasn't the issue to the bride. She actually wanted to be with her potential groom. And, you know, I think that's worth sort of noting. Now, in the Bible, the church is often referred to as the bride of Christ. Or when I say the church, I'm talking about the people that follow Christ. Okay? And that's referred to as the bride of Christ. And Jesus Christ is often referred to as the bridegroom. In fact, there's more references to Jesus being the bridegroom, and hence the church is the bride. And the wedding day is likened to when Jesus returns to be with his people, to collect his church, shall we say. Now, if we go into John's Gospel, you'll be familiar with John the Baptist. And he prepared the way for Jesus. And John baptized people. And then along came Jesus, didn't he? And he ended up doing the same thing, didn't he? He ended up seemingly doing the same thing. And John actually encouraged that. And John actually supported that. But of course, some people started saying, what's going on? Can you explain that? And John entered into this discussion and explained that he's not the Christ. He's the one that was sent ahead of him, but that Jesus is the Christ. And he explains it using this verse: the one who has the bride is the bridegroom. So the one who has the bride, the one who has the people, the one who has the church, he's the bridegroom. And I just put that in to sort of give a scriptural basis to the terminology, really. So Jesus is the bridegroom and the people are the bride. And if you're really into it, there are some other scripture references that refer to that. There's several, but if you want to do your own little study, those are some of them that talk about us being the bride. And of course, when we say the bride, in that respect, we're talking collectively about a group of people. We're talking about the church, not an individual, but a group of people, a collection of people. Now, in 1 Corinthians 12, it talks about us, the church, being one body. Okay? And you've probably, like me, sat through a number of sermons where they talk about being the body of Christ and being one body. And they use all sorts of illustrations. And even though we do that, sometimes it's actually quite hard for us to identify. I don't know why it is, but it's sometimes hard for us as an individual to identify as being part of the body of Christ. And I think sometimes we trap ourselves because we tend to think that there are more prominent members of the church, should we say, that do more, so they are the body, I think of them as the body, I don't think of me as being part of the body. And it's quite unhelpful. And sometimes we think about roles that people do. And what I want to just stress is it's not what people do that actually qualifies them to be part of the body. And sometimes I think we're a lot better now as a church in this respect, but I think it was a weakness of ours. I used to think we used to want responsibilities for this and that, and these were the people that were part of the body. And if you hadn't got a responsibility, then you weren't. If you hadn't got a role, then you weren't part of the body. And that was never the intention, but I think that was an unfortunate, understanding, shall I say, of a time period. But I think we're a lot better than that now. But I mean, it's a little bit like if you were to take me to your family and introduce me to your family, and instead of saying, "This is my mother," you just said, "What she does." You said, "This is the lady that does whatever she does, whether it's the cooking or whether it's the washing or whatever." And you don't actually say, "This is my mother." It's like saying, you know, "This is my..." You might introduce me to your brother, but you don't actually introduce me to him as a brother. You say, "Oh, this is the guy that does this, you know, and he washes a car or whatever he does." But what qualifies you to be in a family is that you're a mother, you're a brother, okay? You're a sister, you're a daughter. And it's a bit like being in the church. What qualifies you to be part of the body is that you're a follower of Christ. It's not about what you do. It is purely about that relationship you have with him. So the bride, it includes each one of us. Now, I wanted to take us into the book of the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon essentially is a love song, or it's a poem, and it focuses on the bridegroom, which is King Solomon, and the bride, which is it's a Shulamite woman. People also take it to mean God's love for Israel, the people of Israel, and people also take it to mean an expression of God's love for the church. Right now, I just want you to think about it as a love poem, okay? As a love poem or a love song. I know the language is very sort of different to what we use in our daily lives, okay? It's a bit Romeo and Juliet style, isn't it? You know, it's a bit over the top, you might think. And some of it, if you might even want to snigger about, you know, and it's okay in a sense. I remember when we got married, we went for a sort of rehearsal of the ceremony. And I can remember, I think it was the bit where it was to have and to hold from this day forth. My wife was saying this as a sort of bit of a practice. And she just got an attack of the giggles. You know, she just couldn't help it. This was in the rehearsal, not actually on the day. And I know another couple that exactly the same thing happened to it. And I was talking to somebody that actually was a vicar that looks after service, and he says, "No, that's normal." He says, "That's normal." He says, "Because people are quite young, and this is language that they're not used to using, you know." So he says, "Yeah, have a giggle, get it out, you know." But on the day, you're actually saying something that is quite powerful, you know. So some of the language in this actually makes us snigger a bit because we're not used to it, but some of the worship songs that we sing, there's quite a few that come from Song of Solomon. "I am my beloved and he is mine" is banner over me is love. That's that one, you know. But there's one or two like that. Anyway, so picking it up in chapter 4, where the male or the lover, shall we say, is Solomon, is expressing his admiration for his bride, okay? "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies until the day breathes and the shadows flee. I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates, with all choicest fruits, henna with nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. Wow. It's quite a passage, isn't it? It's quite a passage. You know, I've actually never heard anybody read that out in church, to be honest. And you can see, can't you, that the lover is totally, totally, totally besotted with his bride, isn't he? He's totally besotted with his bride. And can you capture the intensity of that love relationship that's there? There's a sort of real healthy ferocity about it, isn't there? And you could, some of the imagery, you could really study and take apart, you know, and look at, and it would be interesting to do that. And I'm sure a good scholar could do that. And I'm amazed, really, that I've never known a literature student actually take Song of Solomon and sort of take it apart and express its meanings, because I think you could do a brilliant dissertation on it if they wanted to. But some of it makes you laugh, doesn't it? Or some of it you just, that's just not my thinking. I don't think like that. I mean, the bit that gets me, you know, is your breasts are like two fawns. I mean, the idea of two baby deer stuffed down a woman's bra doesn't do it for me. You know what I mean? It just doesn't work for me. It's because we're not used to the culture and language that it's written in. But if you actually stop and think about Walt Disney's character Bambi, okay, think about Bambi, the little deer, the baby deer. Think about that as a baby deer. It's not fully grown. It's not yet fully developed. It's not yet fully matured. It's full of innocence, isn't it? It's full of purity. And you begin to get a flavour of what this guy's thinking about his bride, you know. And when you start to think like that, that's actually quite beautiful, really, in a way, isn't it? If that really is still too much for you, this song did come to my mind. written by the police in, I reckon it was about early 80s, perhaps, I don't know. Somebody might tell me, I don't know. Every little thing she does is magic. Everything she does just turns me on. Even though my life before was tragic, now I know my love for her goes on. Okay? If you find that easier or helpful, use that. Again, it's the expression of the song is that someone is totally besotted with this lady, with this lover. But what I'd like you to think about, you know, particularly thinking back to the text in Song of Solomon and thinking about how the lady is described, what is it about her that causes such an outburst of poetic literature? What is it about her that causes him to think like that? What's her characteristics does she display? What's her nature? What's her personality like? Now you can look at that and you can probably come up with all manner of things. But I felt three characteristics highlighted to me. Okay. Clearly she's beautiful. Not only physically, but I think much more than physically. You know, I've heard people describe a piece of music as something that is beautiful. You know, it's not necessarily something that you can see. In that case, it's something you can hear, but it can be a description given to the way she behaves, what she says, what she does. Purity was something that comes through, because some of the language is actually quite sensual, and when you actually read the whole book, you can begin to just sense how pure this lady is, not only from a sexual sense, but also from a spiritual sense as well. And the word genuine came to me in the sense that there was no facade about her. She's the real deal. It's not that this is what she is like when she's just in someone's company. It just seems that this is her whole being. This is how she operates. I can imagine her, or rather I can imagine her lover watching her from afar and actually seeing how she behaves and just seeing the genuineness of that. So these are attributes that her lover likes. And so naturally, he likes to be with his bride. But just think about these characteristics as displayed by the church, okay? Think of these characteristics as displayed by the church or as displayed by the bride of Christ. You might be at work, doing the best that you can in your situation. You might be at school or college, and you, again, might be giving your attention and studying and doing what you're supposed to be doing to the best of your intentions and ability. You might be at home doing jobs about the house. You might be mixing with people and socializing with people, again, to the best of your ability. If you've ever been down here in the centre during the day, you know, the things that are going on. You've got Voyager going on. You've got maybe a football going on or badminton, or there's a bereavement counselling and other agencies that make use of the facility. I think God looks at all of that when it's done to the best of the abilities that we have, and he says, that's beautiful. That is beautiful. You know, when you're working hard at the place that God has put you in, he looks at that and he says, that's beautiful. That is beautiful. When I think of purity, I think of a sinless, wholesome way of behaving. And that might be reflected in things that we say or in not only just our moral stance on things, but just in attitudes and behaviours. And I think of genuineness as well. when we're genuine. The thing that I do really like, that I think we express well, certainly our culture, is we're not what I call a Sunday church. You know, we don't come and gather together on a Sunday and then the rest of the week we just forget about it all. You know, when you give your, you know, you seek to follow Christ in all that he wants us to do, it's a 7 day week, 24 hour a week job. You know, there's no facade about it. You know, we don't come on a Sunday just to keep in his good books. You know, it is a wholesome package. I know you can look at these and you think, well, these attributes, yeah, I get what you're saying, because they're obviously things that the groom would like, the attributes that the groom likes, and so hence he would like to be with his bride when these are displayed. And I know you might think, well, that's actually a very high standard, and I don't quite, can't achieve that. I feel I fall short of that. And yes, they are ideal characteristics. We are living in a time of preparation as a church. And the peculiar thing is that actually God understands that as well. In Ephesians, Paul's letter to the Ephesians, he's talking, and what he does is he's using a healthy husband-wife relationship to illustrate the relationship Christ has with the church, or Christ has with his bride. And he uses this, he says these words, or has written these words down. As Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. It's amazing because, you know, previously I'd said that's actually quite a high standard to try and live up to. But what he's saying here is that actually Jesus helps us do it. And actually by the truth that he actually sacrificed himself on the cross has actually allowed us to go free from the consequences of our sins. And it's just an incredible verse to digest and take on board, you know, where it talks about, you know, that he will sanctify. He's talking about the church. He's talking about you. He's talking about me. You know, sanctified is another word for sort of purifying that process. He's going to treat us as holy. He's going to treat us as sinless. He looks at us without blemish. He looks at us and says, you're beautiful. At some time in your life, you may have longed for that perfect partner or dreamed for that perfect relationship. I actually think that God has a very same desire. He thinks in exactly the same way. But the truth of this is that he's actually helping us to be that perfect partner and to fulfill that perfect role. I recall when we visited Bethel Church. It was during the service and there was a time of worship going on. So people were expressing worship. They were singing and dancing and all that stuff, you know. But partway through, I sense it so clearly. I felt a shift in the worship. And what I felt had happened was that all of a sudden, the church, the bride of Christ, had got the attention of Jesus. All of a sudden, as if he was walking along and hearing worship, and then all of a sudden he turned and looked and focused upon the church because he liked what he saw. He liked what he was experiencing. He liked what he was sensing. And his eyes locked on to the church with such love and such desire. And I had this sort of imagery or picture in my mind of two dancers. The one dancer, which I sort of took to be the male dancer, shall I say, was Jesus. And then the second dancer was the church. And as I could see this second dancer was actually, I can't really verbalize this very well, but it was as if that body of the second dancer was made up of lots of things, which I just took to be the different expressions that are in church. You know, all wholesome. You know, it was made up of sort of us. And they were dancing. But there was something so intuitive going on. It took me a while to really understand what was going on. Because, you know, if you've all watched Strictly or whatever, some dances, the male takes the lead, or supposed to take the lead, in some of the dances. But as I watched, I couldn't determine that. I couldn't see, in actual fact, that Jesus was leading the second dancer. But what I did begin to realize was that the church, or the second dancer, was actually moving in a way that Jesus wanted her to move. So he wanted to be with her. He wanted to dance with her. And it was something like intuitive going on. The church was doing what Jesus wanted. So he wanted to dance with the church. And, you know, the thing came in my mind really is, how do we do that? You know, how do we get to, in a sense, cooperate with God's Spirit? How do we get to cooperate and move how he wants us to move? And I can't really think of anything clearer to say other than to stop and think, say we need to do what he likes us to do. We need to go where he likes us to go. We need to move how he likes us to move. And he will spend time with us. He will dance with us. He will go with us. He will move with us. We need to love like he wants us to love. He will love with us. There's like an intuitive cooperation going on in that relationship. And I've already said that his heart's desire is for that, and he's actually wants to help us do that. I felt God highlight just something for me to emphasize here, particularly for the leaders and directors in the church here. Because I think that you've got this in your thinking somewhere. But I felt God say, I don't want it in your thinking somewhere. I want this as your number one priority. And that's what I really felt him saying. I mean, I think it's for us as a church, but I particularly felt he wanted to highlight that to the leaders and directors. He wanted this as your number one priority, that you would seek to cooperate and move with him how he wants to move. And you might think that there's a certain amount of wisdom required for that. And maybe there is. But don't fall into the trap of thinking, I'm in this position as leader or as a director because I have a certain amount of wisdom through life's experience or whatever. Or whatever. And I felt God saying, okay, but I just want you to move. I want to confound your own wisdom, and I want you to move how I want you to move. The book of Proverbs is a great book to get into. It's full of wisdom, isn't it? And I actually really enjoy it because there's a chapter for sort of, there's 31 chapters, so you've got one for each day of the month if you want to read it like that. and I've read it several times, and I'll look at it, and you know how sometimes you can take one proverb or one verse, and you look at it, and I felt, you've probably done this, and you, in a sense, you look at it and think, oh, that's magnificent, you know, and I'll try that, I'll begin to focus on that. And if you're like me, you actually begin to apply your own wisdom to this proverb. And I felt God say to me, okay, that, not saying that's wrong, you know, that's good and healthy. But then I felt, after I'd read the whole book, he said, okay, now I don't want you to apply your wisdom. I want you to sit back and surrender to my wisdom. And it's quite a shift. It's quite a shift in your thinking. And I just felt God wanted to encourage you to do that. And then you can begin to cooperate and move with him how he wants you to move. I've known people pray for babies, right, when they've still been in the mother's womb, okay? And I've known them pray. I think that's really healthy. I've known them to pray that at some day, that as they mature and grow up, that they will meet the partner that God has prepared for them. And I think that's a lovely prayer. I think it's a healthy prayer. And, you know, that's good. Now, as a young man, I had a private thought, and I've never shared this before with anybody, really. I had a private thought that I was, as a young man, I was thinking, I will never be able to get a wife that is the right physical height for me. Okay? That's what I used to think. Little did I know that from birth, God was preparing the perfect partner for me, who's exactly the right stature. Okay? Okay? I mean, you think, okay, that's a nice little story, Bob. But we've just been through the Christmas period, haven't we? And we've celebrated the birth of Jesus as a baby, who ultimately is the saviour of the world. And I just had this thought I believe that God has the same desire for the perfect partner for Jesus. And right from his birth, even then, he was preparing and creating the perfect partner, the church, you and me, to be his bride. And I think that's actually, it's quite a deep thought if you sort of just let it settle in your spirit. There's a passage in Revelation, a verse in Revelation, where it's talking about the when Jesus comes back to collect and to be with his bride. And it says, "For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and the bride has made herself ready." And we have, I just felt God wanted to impress on us that we need to do all we can to make ourselves ready. As we start this new year, we need to stop and think sometimes, what can I do that will please God here? What can I do that will actually attract him to spend time with me? And I think it can be a really enjoyable time. An enjoyable time if you can make that a priority. Now you might be able to reflect on that. And you might be able to just think about, well, actually, what about my attitude here? What about my behaviour? What about just practical things that I do? What will actually attract him to me so that he spends time with me? And I say this because such is Jesus' desire. He wants us to operate in this way because he wants to spend time with us. So we, in a sense, cooperate with him, and he just wants to pour himself into us and through us as a church. So really, you know, that's, I said it was simple. You know, that's what I want us just to reflect on. Now, you might want to just reflect on that yourself. I think there's actually a bit about, as a church, we can reflect on that. You know, there's something there for the leaders and directors, I think, to actually just sit and reflect on. Or it may be that you need to do that at some point this week, or some point, maybe even each day. You know, how am I operating? Am I doing things that actually encourage Jesus to want to dance with me, to actually spend time with me? So, it's as simple as that.